afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm here, well, I should say my co-host Alfred Adisk and James Corbett of the Corbett Report will be here after the first segment of today's program. So let's get started right away for the market report for Thursday, March 30th, 2017. Right before we get to the market report, I was running late. I started reading a book, Pastor Butch Paul's book, Articles of Wisdom and Instruction from God's Word. It's volume one. He sent it to me about a couple weeks ago, and I started reading it right before the program, and it's a very nice book. And I think you can get it on Amazon. You can go to Amazon and pick up Pastor Butch Paul, and he wants to be on the program just as soon as I finish the book, so I thought I would make sure that I attend to it this weekend. It's not a very thick book, and I don't know how many pages it has. It's an easy read. It only has 100 pages. So hopefully we can bring him to the program very soon. I think he's on vacation now. He's going to be coming back to radio pretty soon. But I think in May sometime. So, again, folks, Amazon.com, Articles of Wisdom, Instruction from God's Word, Pastor Butch Paul. Today, we have gold. Did take pressure after the markets closed. So we're still looking at the New York spot price after market, down $9.30 at $1,245. You have silver down 12 cents at $18.20. Platinum is down $4 at $953. Palladium was up $3 today at $798. The USDX today was up 0.56, hitting 100.50. Crude oil a day was also up 82.82 at 50.33. And the paper markets today, of course, the Dow was up significantly. Let me go ahead and bring those numbers up once again. The Dow was up 68 points at 20,728. The NASDAQ was up 16 at 5914. The S&P was up 6 at 2,368. 10-year yield, 2.42%. Up 0.03. The euro was down 0.78 at 107. And let's go see, no one's fearful anymore. It's more fun to be in the greed part of the index, the fear and greed index. So we're moving right on up. We're at 42 today from 29 in the beginning of the week. And what a difference a day or two might make. But, so again, it's I got some interesting reports today. There's so much to talk about. It's really hard to fine tune what I want to share with you. I think the first thing we'll get over is the U.S. economy grew in the fourth quarter at a faster pace than previously reported, and this is all based on higher consumer spending. The Commerce Department's data show today was released by them this afternoon or this morning. The data reinforces the underlying story of the U.S. economy. The seven-year expansion continues to be led by consumers who are cushioned by a firm labor market and rising confidence. Again, led by consumers. When an economy is based strictly on consumption and that consumption is fueled by debt, hey, things don't end well. When rising confidence is based purely on a rising stock market, you have debt and optimism. It's kind of like the yin and the yang. How can you have optimism when you're so far in debt? Not a good sign for the economy, but yet, hey, we can celebrate because the GDP rose at a 2.1 annualized pace, revised from the 1.9%. Consumer spending, the biggest part of the economy, rose at a 3.5% rate, revised from 3%. Corporate profits in the U.S. jumped 9.3% from a year earlier, and that's the most since 2012. Oh, let's see if there's anything else out of there that was interesting. Trade subtracted 1.82% percentage points from growth. And that's the most since 2004. compared with the prior estimate of 1.7-point drag on weaker exports and higher imports. So here they revised their annual GDP, all based on consumer spending. And again, it makes a little more sense than the 1.9, because when we released that number, I had mentioned it really didn't kind of coexist with the higher stock market. So now they readjusted the GDP to make that fit a little bit better. But I mean, when you really do talk about a little over 2% of GDP for a country of this size, you know, it's really fairly pathetic. But speaking of debt, margin debt climbed to a record high in February. The amount investors borrowed against their brokerage accounts climbed to $528.2 billion in February. And that's according to the most recent data available from the New York Stock Exchange that was released yesterday. And that's up almost 3% from January, which had been the first margin debt record in nearly 2 years. With margin debt, investors pledge securities, typically stocks or bonds, to obtain a loan from their brokerage firms. Now, the money doesn't have to be used to buy more investments, though it often does. Rising levels of margin debt are generally considered to be a measure of investor confidence. Investors are more willing to take out debt against investments when shares are rising and they have more value in their portfolios to borrow against. But experts, they say that a steep rise can indicate that investors are losing sight of market risks and they're borrowing, betting that stocks can only go up. Margin debt has a history of peaking right before financial collapses, just like we've seen all the ones before. You can go back to 29, 2000, 2008, you pick your year. But margin debt has a history of peaking. This is your euphoria. You know, things are always going to go higher. You know, people are believing the stock, the Dow is going to go to 30,000. That's a reachable number now. They're blowing caution to the wind. And so again, this is why you have this margin debt increase right before the financial collapses, like we've seen in so many of the past. And when stocks move higher, and when you have these margin debt records, what do Wall Street brokers say? Don't worry, be happy. This isn't a signal that markets reach some exuberant level like they did prior to other major market crashes. They're not leveraging up as they see the market exploding to the upside. They're using leverage because they can pay it off at any time. And this is what they'll tell their people. So record levels of margin debt really do correspond with lower odds for future market returns. And what is going to happen if the markets reverse themselves? You got to come up with the dough, or the broker is going to sell your shares. And what happens sometimes is the broker doesn't have enough of that dough to cover all their sell trades. So again, to borrow against shares, to buy more shares, it's the same. It's not any, how different is it from corporations that go into debt to buy back their shares just to keep their numbers high, to fool the investor? So the investor comes in thinking it's a great share. This is what your stock market is based on. It's a Ponzi scheme. And they have to keep changing it, so they have to get this new money in there. Now, so you had the corporations borrowing to buy back their shares. Now you have the investor is borrowing, leveraging to buy more shares. Does this sound like a normal and healthy market to you? If I was in paper, if I was in the stock market, I'd be very, very afraid if I didn't have it protected by wealth insurance, which of course is gold and silver. And we do have a little package today, $500. We have 1 ounce American silver rounds. Well, they're not American silver rounds. They're the buffalo rounds. 1 ounce buffalo rounds and a 1/10 ounce American Gold Eagle. It includes your shipping costs, $500. It's a great little package for 20 1-ounce silver rounds and 1 1/10-ounce American Gold Eagle. It includes your shipping costs for $500. It's a great buy, folks. So give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Yesterday we talked about robots, delivery service, the pizza, and Bill, a listener, wrote the following. I had to share it with you. Those who think that a robot is going to take the jobs of those who deliver pizzas will have to show them a robot that can carry a pizza from a self-driving car to the door of the house or apartment or wherever it is being delivered without getting lost or confused by the things that a pizza delivery driver takes in stride. And he was referencing when we were talking yesterday about the CEO of Yum, and he says he doubts if the CEO of Yum ever delivered a pizza from Pizza Hut. Even if he had, he probably never delivered one to someone who worked in the particular Pizza Hut where it was made, so it is extremely doubtful that the former Pizza Hut employees will ever be on the receiving end of a Pizza Hut pizza being delivered by a Yum executive. Is that any sillier than anything that the CEO of Yum said? And I somewhat agree with him. What happens when the robot gets hit in the pedestrian walkway when he doesn't wait until he is told to walk? You know, you're supposed to give the pedestrian the right of way, but do you give robots the right of way in a pedestrian walkway? We'll have to see if that's been tested. However, in February, this is just one of the companies. There's a couple of them. You have delivery startup Postmates, and you have DoorDash. Well, Postmates began testing ground robots in D.C. in February, and DoorDash will follow suit in Redwood City. I guess that's in California. Postmates is a logistics company that operates a network of couriers who deliver goods locally. Postmates is closely compared to Uber because its use of mobile phones to receive orders and dispatch delivery drivers. As of December 2014, Postmates operates in 18 U.S. cities. As of October 2015, their website lists more than 100 metropolitan areas, and I think I saw they have like 16,000 delivery people, and the service is part of a category of business that relies on mobile phone applications and their global positioning system capabilities to quickly match inventories and consumer demand. They are testing delivery robots. These robots hold deliveries in their halls, which flip open with the push of a button. For now, Starship Technologies, which is led by Skype's co-founders, and they're the ones who make the robots, will have an employee walking behind the robot to keep it out of trouble and answer any questions from curious pedestrians. Starship Technologies has covered 16,000 miles in last year, including tests in Britain, Germany, Switzerland, Estonia. The DoorDash and Postmates programs are its first partnerships in the United States. My question is, what's the point of having robot deliveries if you need an employee walking behind? Kind of reminds me when they told me that if you use computers, we'll become a paperless society. Well, I probably use more paper now than I did when I used a three-part form and typed the invoice on a typewriter. Now, you know, we're not on the internet, but we use a computer to type the invoices and everything. And I probably go through more paper now than I did when I did a three-part form. It was much simpler. It was easier. The only thing I can say about the computer is when we go from the address on the invoice to the shipping label, you never have to worry about that shipping label being retyped. And to more things you handle, the more likelihood you can have a mistake. But even when we typed the three-part invoices, we never had a mistake. So again, it's kind of interesting. So robot deliveries than pizza? Maybe. Maybe. There was something that was a little disturbing today about something that, and again, this is from the Wall Street Journal. And I believe Mr. Trump is going to sign off on a measure. He's going to sign this measure into law. And it's the telecom giants can mine your web history. Congress's repeal of FCC privacy rules could be data boon for Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T. And these telecom companies can track the websites you visit, the apps you use, the TV shows you watch, the stores you shop at, and the restaurants you eat at, and then sell that information to advertisers. Now, we already know that Google and all your search engines, I mean, they all collect your data and so forth. But this will certainly give the telephone companies, the telecom companies, provide and this web browsing and collecting this data to a much bigger degree. By signing this into law, and Donald Trump intends to sign the measure into law, he's undoing the rules which had been adopted last fall by the FCC, but hadn't gone into effect. And so Verizon Communications, AT&T, Comcast, they're all in the process of building data-driven digital ad businesses to complement the broadband, wireless, and TV services that they offer. The telecom providers had argued the rules put them at a competitive disadvantage to online giants Google and Facebook, which generally aren't regulated by the FCC. So as I mentioned, Google and Facebook have built huge businesses powered by reams of data that they collect about consumers' online actions, but on their own properties and across the web. And that trove of information largely explains their dominance, but what the telecoms can do, they can really take this a lot further. So if you sneeze in your home at 3 in the morning or as you're driving to the store to pick up some cough syrup for your wife or for yourself, they will know that. So again, I like to hear from you. Send me an email, discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com, what you think about changing this ruling so that these telecom companies can further use and mine your data. 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver packages today. I hear the music. That means James Corbett and Alfred Adask will be here in just a few short minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver at 1-800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver coin needs. Our guest is James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. James is calling in from Japan, and James is being increasingly recognized as the intellectual resource. People concerned with geopolitical issues, and maybe more than geopolitical, but that's enough to, that's enough. That sounds, does that sound good enough for now, James?
You know, that's more than enough to fill our plate in this day and age, I think.
I agree. You've recently published an unauthorized biography and video of David Rockefeller, and I can only say that David died just in the last week or 10 days at the age of 101. Is this evidence that only the good die young?
It certainly appears to be that way, especially when you take into account that his grandfather, John D. Rockefeller, the founder of the Rockefeller dynasty, himself had a boyhood dream of making $1 million and living to 100 years old. Well, he made much more than $1 million, but only lived to 97, and so I guess David surpassed him in that.
Well, what do we know about, what does your unauthorized biography reveal about Mr. Rockefeller?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think we have to keep a couple of things in mind. First of all is that, as anyone who has looked at any of the cursory kind of biographies or wrap-ups of David Rockefeller and his life in the mainstream might have seen, it has been defined in the mainstream as him being some sort of philanthropist who only cares about humanity and did what was best for the world and all of that PR that the Rockefeller family has bought ever since John D. Rockefeller Jr. was facing the Ludlow Massacre backlash and literally created the modern PR industry with the help of his father's friend Ivy Lee, the founder, the creator of modern PR. He was brought on to help reshape the Rockefeller's image in the wake of that tragedy and did quite a good job because, of course, ever since then, the Rockefeller family has been acquainted with the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller University and all of these wonderful philanthropic things it does around the world. Now, people who have watched my How Big Oil Conquered the World documentary, which is available for free online, just type that into a search engine, will know that Rockefeller philanthropy is never about making the world a better, shinier, happier place, unless, of course, your last name happens to be Rockefeller, in which case, I guess it does happen to redound to your benefit. But, I mean, it's doubly an affront on the David Rockefeller case, because not only, and just generally, have the Rockefellers been neck-deep in all sorts of self-serving philanthropies, but David himself spent the vast majority of his career, his time, his money, and his efforts on the business side of the Rockefeller family, namely the banking business, as he got into Chase when he was younger, Chase National, which became Chase Manhattan, which became J.P. Morgan Chase, and he was intimately involved with that, becoming chairman and CEO and president of that bank. But so that was what consumed a great majority of his life. But of course, on the side, he had all of these other organizations that he helped found, fund, create in one way or another, including, but not limited to, so things like the Council of the Americas, where he pushed for the free trade area for all of the Americas, basically NAFTA for the entire Western Hemisphere. And of course, always the groups like the Council on Foreign Relations, which he directed for 15 years, was a member for decades, the the Bilderberg Group, which he was a founding member of, an advisor to the steering committee, very influential. And then when the Bilderberg Group didn't want to include Japan in their talks, which he thought they should, he went off and created a new group, the Trilateral Commission, from which the vast majority of cabinet-level positions in the last several administrations have come, as Patrick Wood has talked about in his work on technocracy and how the Trilateral Commission shaped that. So his legacy is much, much different than the one you're going to read about in the mainstream news. So I wanted to get this out into the public consciousness before that image of the nice, smiling, happy billionaire philanthropist who only cares about puppy dogs and rainbows gets too firmly embedded in there.
Now, how intimately was he associated with the onset of the New World Order?
I don't think you can extract the Rockefellers from that. I think it's also important, the other side of this is to say that, of course, it's not that David Rockefeller was personally the New World Order, and now that he is gone, the New World Order is over. I think, obviously, that would be a simplification. But he's been at the heart of it. I tend to think that the people whose names we know, at one level or another, are gophers. They may be super gophers, but yeah. I imagine that the real power players, we don't even know their names, or they operate completely in the shadows, but certainly David Rockefeller would be at the top of that gopher pyramid, and right underneath him would be his emissary, servant, dutiful henchman, Henry Kissinger, who was personally selected by David, who worked with him on a Council on Foreign Relations study group in the, I believe, the 1950s, where he was discovered by the Rockefeller family and then used by Nelson Rockefeller in his political career and the Rockefeller family generally, and became basically a David Rockefeller's emissary to administration after administration. And as I point out in the documentary, it's not that Henry Kissinger went away in the 1970s after he officially left government. Of course, he's been an advisor to almost every president since then, in one capacity or another, including and up right up until the doorstep of Donald Trump, where he's met Donald on several occasions. They're friends, they talk to each other, and Donald Trump consults him on foreign policy, so more of the same. And unfortunately, this means that just because David Rockefeller died, the agenda, the globalist agenda he was promoting, did not die with him.
What's his relationship to George Soros, or what was his relationship to George Soros?
That's a good question. I don't know of any direct connections between the two. I mean, I'm sure that they knew each other and worked in the same circles, but I don't know what kinds of connections they had. I think that they tended to operate in different spheres, but I mean, again, working towards the same goal in the ultimate bigger scheme of things, but from different sides of the phony political spectrum, at any rate. I mean, Soros obviously associated more with the Democrats and the left side. The Rockefellers more associated with the Republicans, but then again, Rockefeller Republicans, which, as most Republicans would say, aren't really Republicans at all. But anyway, again, I think that just shows the meaninglessness of it. It's like saying Kissinger is on the right and Brzezinski is on the left, but Rockefeller invented Kissinger, in a sense, and he invented Brzezinski, in a sense, by making him the co-founder of the Trilateral Commission. So I don't think that those kinds of distinctions have much meaning. So I don't know if Rockefeller and Soros coordinated very carefully on anything, but I think ultimately they were working towards the same goals.
Do you think they were competitors to any significant degree, or they were, you know, apex predators, and you take care, you got the woods over there and I got the woods over here, and let's not cross the line? Right, you stay on your
right.
You predate over there, and I'll predate over here. Could they have been competitors, or could anyone? Was anyone a real competitor with Mr. Rockefeller, David Rockefeller?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there is competition that goes on. I think it would be naive to see it either way, to either extreme, that they were completely complicit with each other on everything, or that they were completely in opposition on everything. I don't think it's like that. I think that there are certain things and certain business interests that they have that compete with each other, and I think there is genuine competition that goes on there. But as I say, I think the overall idea, the overall goal of one world government and all of that is the same. It's just they might have different ways of getting there and different ideas about it, and so they can cooperate on various organizations and philanthropies and things as the need arises, and they can compete in business and politics and everything else as the need for that arises. So I think it's not quite so clear-cut in either direction. It just means that at certain times their interests converge, and at certain points they diverge.
I've seen reports that oil is the single biggest industry in the world, And as I understand it, I'm not a student of the Rockefeller Foundation and the Rockefeller clan, but my understanding is that their fortune was built on oil, and yet he wound up moving into banking to some significant degree. Which do you think he regarded as more important, oil or banking?
This is somewhat my interpretation and my layover. I don't know of any specific quote that he has on this, but I think that the sense is that banking was ultimately where the Rockefellers wanted to go and moved into with their money. It's something that explicitly John D. Rockefeller Jr., the son of Sr., the founder of Standard Oil, looked at and was thinking about actively in the time when the brothers, the so-called brothers, David and his brothers, were coming up, his children were coming up and getting to the point where they were going to start assuming the family fortune. John D. Rockefeller Jr. was thinking quite explicitly about how to get the family more intimately involved with financial institutions of various sorts, including banks, the banking industry, the sector generally, because he knew that would be ultimately the way to manage the family fortune. And at least the sort of mainstream historian biographers of the family say that that was a point of discord between Junior and Senior. John D. Rockefeller Senior, coming from the generation where people stuffed their cash under the mattress and didn't trust the banks. John D. Rockefeller Junior being more, no, we'll own the banks, so don't worry about that. And ultimately, I think that won out. And so the National Citibank, the Chase National Bank, was seen popularly as the Rockefeller family bank. It had John D. Rockefeller Jr. was the largest shareholder, and it had a relative of the Rockefeller family in Aldrich sitting on as the president, I believe, at the time. It was very much within the Rockefeller orbit already, but then, of course, David, after leaving the University of Chicago, where he got his PhD in economics, went on directly into the bank and started his career and ultimately ended up basically running and taking over the bank. So I think the Rockefellers definitely made their move from oil into banking, and I think that was definitely part of a conscious attempt that they made to understand that ultimately the ultimate way to preserve their fortune was not going to be dealing in a commodity. It was going to be dealing with money itself.
Does this have anything to do with the petrodollar, which is the one place in recent history where banking and the oil industry seemed to intersect in a meaningful way? Kissinger was credited with devising the scheme or the guarantee not to sell his crude oil for anything other than fiat dollars, and the result was the dollar was effectively backed by oil. So here we have oil, and we have banking, and it sounds like this would be a perfect setup for the Rockefellers. Did they play a significant role there?
Well, you're 100% correct in your framing of it there, and it was Henry Kissinger that did devise the petrodollar, and it is the Saudis leading the way and setting the standard for the world in pricing their oil in dollars. And then another part, a key part of that whole system is that they would recycle those dollars back through the U.S. banking system by buying U.S. treasuries through U.S. financial places like Chase. So ultimately, yes, David Rockefeller personally benefited from that, but also in the larger sense that obviously the Rockefellers still have shares in what Standard Oil was broken out into. So they have that interest. And of course, Henry Kissinger, as I say, was the Rockefeller emissary to the world, and is a question mark. I guess he may be his own operator now that he's in his 90s. But at any rate, I think that is an absolutely essential story to understanding the modern world. And you're exactly right. I mean, to a certain extent, the Rockefellers were the ones that monopolized the industry, the commodity that became the backbone of the global economy and then became the backbone of the global monetary system, which they were also heavily involved in. So I think that's how we have to understand this. And that's where you start to get the sense of how much power families that are situated in that matrix can wield. And that's exactly why the big standard joke of half a century ago was, why doesn't David Rockefeller run for president? He doesn't want a demotion.
Yeah. Tell folks where they can visit the unauthorized biography of David Rockefeller. Where can they catch that on your blog or wherever?
The best place to go would be corporatereport.com/Rockefeller. Just type that in, and that will take you to the transcript. You can watch the YouTube video from there. You can download the MP3 audio. All of the sources are there. As always, it's 100% free, so I hope people will take advantage of that.
You also have another podcast up there, if I'm a video, How Big Oil Conquered the World. Why don't you give us a little idea of how big oil conquered the world, and is it a conquest, or is it a natural phenomenon because energy is so important to the modern economy?
Right. Yes. Well, this is a documentary that I created in late 2015, I believe December 2015, and there is a second part that is going to be coming, forthcoming very soon, I hope. But I've been saying that for a long time. But anyway, the story of how big oil conquered the world, as you say, I think is, I mean, there is that dual sense of it. One is that this is the natural sort of way in which the economy grew on the backbone of this commodity, which turned out to be exceptionally useful. It was useful, first of all, for getting the economy weaned off of whale oil as ways of lighting homes, and ultimately turned into kerosene. And then when the electric light bulb was threatening that, then along comes the internal combustion engine. And suddenly this byproduct of oil refining, gasoline, becomes extremely important. So it has definitely worked out for those who those early pioneers who monopolized the oil industry, including the Rockefellers in America. The Rothschilds were heavily involved in the monopolization in Europe, and the British and Dutch royal families were also heavily involved in that. So those are the main families and interests that I tracked in that documentary, and how the oil industry became the backbone of the global economy, as we say, in the dual sense, both the commodity itself and also as the underlying part of the global monetary system. And then from that point, it talks about the ways that that fortune has been wielded to do things philanthropically through the Rockefeller Foundation and other things. As I say, we have to put the big question mark over top of all of those activities, because ultimately there are things like the so-called Green Revolution, where they revolutionized agriculture around the world by basically putting money in the pockets of the Rockefellers and their cronies in agriculture, big agri. And then the Gene Revolution, which again is basically the exact same companies and helping the exact same families that helped create the big oil industry. So that's where that documentary tracks. And then the second part that's going to be forthcoming is going to be more about how ultimately this has transitioned away from oil itself as a commodity. We are going to the post-carbon future, like it or not, hook or by crook, in whatever way that comes, and it's going to be heavily shaped by these exact same interests who now are not tied into oil itself. They are tied into all sorts of other schemes which will basically further their power and wealth.
We're going to take a break for a couple of commercials and be back on Financial Survival in just a moment with our guest, James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Won't you take me back to school? I need to learn the golden rule. Won't you lay it on the line? I need to hear it just one more time.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk. I'm here with James Corbett from the Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. And we've been talking about the Rockefeller, David Rockefeller's death and the primacy of oil and the relationship with fiat dollars since the 1970s. All very conspiratorial, make for perhaps a great novel or a great history book. But what's going to happen now? We do seem to be getting to a point. We have a glut of oil in the world. There are more oil producers that are selling their currency, or excuse me, selling their crude oil for currencies other than the dollar. The dollar is still the primary world reserve currency, the primary petrocurrency, but other currencies are beginning to move in on that a little bit. What does this say about the future of the fiat dollar?
Well, I think the first part that you gesture towards there is, what does this say about the future of oil? And it's interesting putting together that big oil documentary. Something that I knew in a sort of theoretical sense, but I really hit home when I was researching that, was that really from the beginning of the oil industry, time and time and time and time again, the primary concern of oil producers was always, we're pumping too much of this stuff. There's too much. We can't get a good price for it. People are pumping too much, too much, too much. And that's still the problem today. People are still, the oil industry majors are still worried. There's too much of this. There's a glut. We have to cut down production. We have to form these cartels. At the same time as we're being told, it's running out. We're reaching the last drop. Peak oil happened, 15 years ago. Oh, wait, no, 10 years ago. No, 5 years in the future. So it's funny that that has been the driving concern. And I think that's the reason why, one of the primary reasons why we're being transitioned forcefully into this post-carbon world by the Paris Climate Agreement, which, oh, by the way, Trump said he was going to scrap on day one, and, looks like he's not going to scrap it. So we're still being transitioned into this post-carbon world, and ultimately what that means, I think, is going to be a very directed and controlled society, because, again, control of energy has always been the control of civilization itself, or at least certainly since the industrial era. And that's exactly the secret that the Rockefellers used to become the Rockefellers. And I think enterprising people of the current day and age who want to create a monstrosity like this Standard Oil monstrosity should be looking at that as their example. They should create, the green monstrosity that will take its place. Now, what does that say about the future of the U.S. dollar and its position in the world currency? I think there is a way that this could ultimately work out for the U.S. dollar, insofar as this is, in effect, a takedown of a lot of American geopolitical competitors. I mean, as was pointed out during the big oil price crash of the last couple of years, who did this ultimately hurt the most? It was countries like Russia, countries like Venezuela, people who have been on the U.S. State Department hit list for a very long time that are heavily dependent on oil exports and who have taken a huge hit. Another huge hit has been taken by Saudi Arabia, which has heavily dipped into its reserves in as a way of trying to prop itself up as its oil exports, oil revenues decline. And they have a huge welfare state that has been created basically to ensure that the Saudi family, the House of Saud, doesn't get thrown off the throne. they've bought their way into political favor with the people, and they have to continue to provide that, or they're going to get their heads on the chopping block. So they're very motivated, and they're starting to divest of Saudi Aramco. So some huge changes are taking place. Ultimately, one of the big, if not winners, at least not the biggest loser, has certainly been the United States, which through the shale revolution has become a net oil exporter, an energy exporter, which is, I mean, astounding to think about, and what that entails in terms of this transition society. And the only question then is, well, then what will come along to replace the petrodollar? What will underlie the system if it's not oil? And I think that's still up in the air. For a long time, though, you could say essentially it is the barrel of the gun that has been the underlying factor in all of this. It was the U.S. offer of the military umbrella to Saudi, the Saudis, that helped convince them of the necessity to denominate in dollars. So ultimately, it has been the barrel of the gun that's underlain all of this. And as long as the U.S. continues to spend hundreds of billions of dollars going towards $1 trillion on defense every year, I don't see a competitor that's going to rise up anytime in the near future, unless, of course, best enemy's money you can buy, unless, of course, the U.S. creates its competitors, which, of course, it has been doing with China for decades now. So it's an interesting system, and one in which the U.S. could continue to come out on top. I think that's a perfectly plausible scenario for the way this will ultimately shake down. The only question is, will the potential competitors to that U.S. power actually gang up and do something like withdrawing from the U.S. Treasury purchasing that has underlain the blank check that the U.S. has had to expand their power around the globe for the last half century?
You talk about peak oil. There's an alternative theory, abiotic oil, where the oil, which presumes, peak oil presumes that there was only so much oil derived from the dinosaurs and whatever happened in prehistoric times. It got trapped underground, and there's only so much, and we're pulling it out so fast that it's going to disappear. Abiotic oil presumes that actually the oil, the crude oil, is somehow being built closer to the core of the earth, and it continues to replenish the system. There's new oil being built all the time. So I'm wondering, which one of these philosophies, which one of these theories do you think is correct? Peak oil or abiotic oil? Or do you agree with that? Do you agree with that breakdown?
I think there is such a thing as biotic oil, but I think there is also abiotic oil.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's not even really controversial, because we know that there exists oil, quote unquote, in space, and of course that is not biotic, that is abiotic in nature. But I mean, the bigger point of all of this is that the old theory, as you say, that this is all just the juice from crushed up old dinosaur bones, is on its face pretty ridiculous when you think of the
today
oceans.
It's pretty ridiculous, but it was common knowledge. Everybody,
yeah, exactly,
like 10,
right,
15 years ago, well, of course, that was obvious.
Yes. These giant underground lakes of oil were apparently just to where all the mass graves of some, you know, dinosaur holocaust or something. I don't know. I mean, it's such a strange theory when you actually start to think about it.
Yep.
I would direct people to an article like Confessions of an Ex-Peak Oil Believer by William Engdahl from 2007, where he lays out his transformation from a believer in peak oil into someone who is not a believer by examining precisely that history of the development of the abiotic theory of oil development, which came out of the USSR. It really started, yeah, in the 1950s with some Russian researchers who were basically mandated by the glorious communist government to find oil. like it or not, you're going to find oil. And, of course, by the old theory that this is all just basically dinosaur bones, Russia, no one expected there would be deposits in Russia. Now Russia is one of the largest holders of oil deposits in the world. How did that happen? It was because in the 50s, people like Professor Vladimir Porfiriev, I'm sorry to mispronounce that, but at any rate, people like that were talking about how crude and oil and natural petroleum gas, quote, have no intrinsic connection with biological matter originating near the surface of the earth. They are primordial materials which have been erupted from great depths. And based on that theory, the Russians started drilling in Siberia and places where, again, no one was expecting by the old theories to find anything. And as I say, they are now one of the largest oil exporters in the world. So based on that theory is how the Russia became the oil exporter that it is. And that's, I mean, that's a fascinating story and one that goes directly against this. And obviously that pokes a lot of holes in the peak oil idea. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, that isn't necessarily a mortal blow, because the comeback may be, well, okay, this may be self-generating from within the crust of the earth and it may be bubbling to the surface or whatever. But if you take up all the easily accessible oil, then you have to go further and deeper down to get the oil, so you can get less and less of it because it requires more and more effort. So that's that. I mean, that's the way that peak oil believers would continue to promote that theory. I think that's questionable in and of itself, because if there's any science, it's not just an inexact science talking about how much, you know, oil reserves and how much is left and how many billions of barrels and all of that. It's also a heavily manipulated one, because of course oil companies and countries in general have extreme vested interests in not disclosing their actual holdings of oil. Again, it's very much about manipulation of people's perception of how much oil exists, which manipulates the price that they are able to extort.
Is this a little bit like the diamond industry, where there's
yeah,
far more diamonds being pulled out of the ground than if we sold them at a real cost?
Yes. I mean, diamonds are semi-precious stones. They are not that, and there are places in the world where they are not uncommon at all, but if you can monopolize and centralize and make sure you have control over those places and where it's freely available, then you can manipulate the supply, and from manipulating the supply, you get the higher price, and that's exactly what's happening with oil. So I think that has to be taken into account. Now, shale developments and other things have really changed the entire prospect. What was seen as not reserves of oil are now seen as reserves of oil. So it's changing the entire calculus, and the peak oil believers who said that doomsday arrived 10 years ago have obviously had to, you know, revise those findings. Okay, well, we staved it off for another 5 or 10 years, but honest, trust us, the sky really is
going to run out any minute now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a failed theory, I think. But I mean, again, I think one of the key points of the people who scream about peak oil isn't necessarily wrong, even if their understanding of the science is wrong, because there is the manipulation of the supply of oil. And that is, I mean, whether it's scientifically because they can't get enough out, or it's because of political factors, i.e. they don't want to drill so that they can keep the price up, the end result from our perspective might look the same. Oh, we're running out of oil. We don't have enough oil. So we have to start doing, you know, the X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z always turn out to be things that are funded by things like the Rockefeller Foundation and involve, you know, geoengineering and genomic changes and all of these types of things. And ultimately, this is the type of thing that's going to drive this post-carbon transition period that we're going into, that's all wrapped in the cloak of, oh, it's for the earth. You don't hate the earth, do you? Oh, we're saving the earth. And it's always the people who say they're saving
the
earth.
They're always good deed doers, and they're here to help us.
Exactly.
Is there any way to cut the supply of oil other than to bomb some nations' oil fields? I mean, we've tried, OPEC has tried to cut the production. We all agree we're going to take, right? We all promised to cut production. How long does that last, if it even really begins? Can they effectively cut production when some nations are screaming just to feed their people? I don't see how that's possible other than bomb the oil fields. And does this play into Middle East politics? Has this been motivating wars in the Middle East for the past 20 years? More?
Yes. I mean, I don't think it's as decisive as it is sometimes portrayed in the alternative media, but it is certainly true that Saddam Hussein was pumping too much oil before the first Gulf War, and that was, I think, a significant part of the factor of the decision to invade in the first Gulf War. And then in the second Gulf War, that was around the time that Saddam was talking about starting euro-denominated oil sales, which, of course, again, would undermine the petrodollar. So that can't be allowed to happen. So I think that has to be seen. I don't think it's definitive and the only factor, but it is certainly a factor that has played a part in the turmoil and destruction of the Middle East in the last couple of decades. It's a part of, it's the reason why the Middle East is important geopolitically at all, I would say. It's more so than its location or anything about the place in overall. It's primarily about oil resources. Everyone understands that, and everyone has. And ultimately the problem again isn't not enough oil, it's too much oil, and who gets to put the cap on that wellhead and control how much dribbles out.
And it seems like the one who can put the cap on the wellhead is the one who's got the best tanks or bombers. I mean, if you really want to cap a wellhead, at least stop it from producing. You may produce a lake, but you're not going to be able to pump it over to refineries easily and the rest of that.
Exactly right.
So the Middle East continues to turn and turn and turn.
And actually, that's another part of the way that that can be controlled. Even if you do, I mean, pump all the oil you want, but if the refineries aren't being built, if there isn't the refinery infrastructure for that, then it's not going to reach the market. So, they can be saved, which is exactly why there hasn't been a lot of investment in refineries in the United States for a very long time. And you have all these aging refineries that are all, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico and places that are prone to disruptions. Again, I think that ultimately benefits the people who want to jack the prices up and make you keep everything on that knife edge so that they can always threaten the supply.
Do you think the refineries enjoy any special levels of protection? And I don't merely mean by the military. I mean, are there people in positions of power, wealthy people like the Rockefellers, say, we're not bombing any refineries? Is that possible, or is it just a bad conspiracy theory? And we've got about 20 seconds.
Well,
maybe we have 30.
Well, the historical precedent for that would be, for example, in World War II, you'll notice that the Ford plant in and other places like that in Germany that had obvious connections to their American parent companies were not bombed in a lot of the bombing raids. Clearly, you know, if they want to avoid certain locations, they can be told, and they're not told by military planners so much as the lawyers and backers of these corporations that ultimately undergird the whole system.
All right, James, thanks very much for being on the program. As always, I enjoy it. It's fun for me just to find questions, try to find intelligent questions, and it's always fun listening to your answers. I want to thank you folks for listening in the audience. I'll be back with James in about 2 weeks. Tomorrow I'll be back with Melody. Please tune in to Financial Survival. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, James Corbett, and Todd the producer. Bye-bye.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me.
That's too bad.